when you're a kid, you don't really fully understand that the way you see the world is not the way everyone else sees the world. You kind of assume your template is just what everyone else is working with as well. And I didn't really have the words for anxiety, or it wasn't as, you know, culturally thrown around when I was a kid. So I think I just thought, you know, life was hard and scary and everyone else just seemed to be coping with it a lot better than I did. Like, everything for some reason took me like a little bit more effort and wherewithal than it seemed like my peers. Things like swallowing pills, or like meeting a new dog, or roller skating, learning to ride a bike, like everything that you're just like, oh, the like adventures of being a kid. I was just like, this is terrifying.
Yeah, I have a lot of anxiety. I don't know. I feel like it's weirder to not have anxiety than to have it, because I feel like if you're not scared, you're not paying attention. You know? Like, I feel like if you open a newspaper today, skim maybe three headlines, you're just like, seems cool. It's like, what? Everything's on fire. Even the newspaper is on fire. Like, what are you so chill about?
I would say my general anxiety is kind of shows up in the same way of just feeling that I'm gonna like make a fool of myself, or just like make other people sort of disgusted with me. But it will be about just everyday tasks, like even like buying a coffee and like making small talk with the barista. I'll be like, oh my gosh, you said the dumbest question, or whatever it is. Like, I take it too far in my head.
We know from a variety of publications that anxiety and depression have risen dramatically during the pandemic, possibly doubled. And for many of us, myself included, it's also something we've dealt with throughout our lives. I'm Dacher Keltner, and welcome to The Science of Happiness. Today, we're going to explore a new way to cope with anxiety by leaning into it rather than trying to repress it. And here to join us is comedian, writer, and actress Aparna Nancherla. Later in the show, we'll hear from Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari, a psychologist and anxiety expert, about how to look at anxiety through a new lens.
Anxiety can be an ally, but like any ally, you need to negotiate.
More after this break. Hi, it's Dacher. If you're like me, you probably have a wide variety of interests when it comes to your podcast listening. A little psychology here, a little history there. Which is why I want to recommend a show perfect for those with eclectic tastes. Freakonomics Radio has more than 10 years and 500 episodes worth of answers to your biggest questions. But don't be fooled, it's not just for economists and business experts. Every week, Stephen Dubner dives into the hidden side of everything. With the help of guests, including CEOs, artists, and Nobel laureates, he breaks down all sorts of things, like how we choose the people we marry, and why using swear words might be more important than you think. So don't miss out. Follow Freakonomics Radio right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Support for The Science of Happiness comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything. CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it, Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/happiness. That's odoo.com/happiness. Welcome back to The Science of Happiness. I'm Dacher Keltner. Today, we're focusing on something that more of us have been feeling lately than ever before, anxiety. Our guest today, Aparna Nancherla, is a comedian, writer, and actress in New York City, whose stand-up often focuses on her own experiences living with depression and anxiety. She joins us today after trying a practice designed to help us think about our anxiety in a new way that hopefully will help us suffer less from it. Aparna, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Since anxiety is so central to your humor, when did you really start to realize, like, oh, I get it, I'm kind of an anxious person and this is just part of who I am?
I was a kid of two immigrants from India, and I think, you know, they were very much of the generation of just assimilation and trying to blend in. So I think early on, I learned not to be too big about my feelings and kind of play everything close to the vest. So I think when I saw examples of anxiety in culture, like it seemed a lot like, you know, like very outward focused and you can see how nervous the person is. And because that didn't really fit me, I think mine is just very internal. And yeah, it all kind of goes imploding versus exploding. Culturally now, we've just sort of gotten to this place where there are so many spheres that feel like they're kind of spiraling, whether it's the environment or politics or just, you know, the economy or the pandemic. And I think anxiety has become almost like a shorthand of being like, okay, all of these things are going badly. At least we can all admit we feel really bad about it, even though we don't know what to do.
Yeah, it's almost like saying, I live in this strange time.
Yeah, like a sort of collective way of checking in with each other. Might make you feel less alone, but in the moment, it's not necessarily going to make you feel less anxious.
Yeah. We asked you to try this practice in being at peace with anxiety that we created with Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari, who has a new book out about anxiety. And the practice is based on this idea that, you know, what we really can focus on is how to change how we think about our experiences of anxiety. And what you do is you ask yourself what you're feeling anxious about right now. Take a few moments to write it out. And then you ask yourself, is there something I can do about this thing that I care about? And if you can, then you do it. And then if not, you do a practice like breathing that sort of calms you down. How did you follow those steps in your approach to changing your thinking about anxiety?
Well, I mean, the nice thing was that, you know, it was like, take a moment when you're feeling anxious. And I was like, oh, okay, I can really do this at any time. A lot of mine shows up around work. So basically before I start any task or like if I have to go to a meeting or jump on the phone, like there's just always a rush of dread. The really helpful thing with this exercise particularly was the writing about it part at the beginning. It kind of made me have to parse out like what outcome are you like so afraid of? And then when I did it, I was like, oh, these, once I break it into like concrete tasks or like what do I want to happen, this actually doesn't feel as overwhelming.
What did you write about? Do you remember?
I think one of them was about I was shooting just a day on an independent film, and I think I wrote, you know, I'm afraid I won't be funny on set, or like I won't remember my lines and I'll be like wasting people's time. And then I was like, no, you memorized your lines. You know how to be like funny around other people. You're like pleasant to work with. You're not rude. So it just helped to remind myself of like you've done these things before and you're not like someone else who's like just coming in completely unprepared or unaware of what's going on. The part of the exercise of like look at your anxiety as sort of a positive motivational force was really interesting because I do think my anxiety is very much tied to not letting other people down, trying to make a good impression and like make other people pleased with me.
I can't even talk to babies without getting self-conscious. Yeah, like the whole time I'm just like, oh, what if I'm not an interesting shape or color, you know?
And so I was like, yeah, I think I maybe care too much sometimes of like what other people think or like giving it way more meaning than it should have over how I feel about myself. Like, I think there's a lot of, I don't know if it's American cultural construct or just like humans of like confidence and outgoingness and like that is always preferable. And like, I just think it couldn't be that only the cavemen who are like, you know, charging straight for the saber-toothed tiger were the only necessary ones. Like, you definitely needed a couple people to stay back and be like, eh, I'm going to sit this hunt out.
Can you give us an example of how these different strategies that are part of this practice of like naming it, thinking of what you can do, recognizing there's stuff that you can't do anything about, like controlling where the airplane goes or whatever it is. Can you give us a specific context in which you tried one of these practices and what that was like?
Yeah, I'm also working on a book right now, fittingly, about self-doubt and imposter syndrome.
Have you written anything?
I know. I was like, if really if this book was just completely blank, it would be accurate. But no, yeah, thankfully I'm in sort of the home stretch. But I do find that I panic before I start working on it. I panic while I'm working on it. And then I panic after I'm done working on it. Like, I think it's just I've created sort of the ultimate vacuum of anxiety. But I tried the exercise for that, and it was helpful to just take a few minutes to be like, what are you trying to get out of this work right now? And like, what can you control in terms of getting it done? And I think as a perfectionist, the hardest part about writing is being like, oh my gosh, this is the best sentence I can write. Like,
impossible.
Come on, like, this is just not good enough. So I think just acceptance and like making peace with what is and like what's happening in the moment is sometimes most of the battle. I think I'm learning one thing that is always helpful with anxiety is doing, you know, a breathing exercise or like a grounding exercise. And I find when I'm really anxious, and just in general a lot when I'm going about my day, I'm not really in touch with my body. I feel like I'm just like a sort of floating head, and I forget that there's like more of me. And then when I'm sort of just like, you know, forced to take a moment and like feel into the rest of me, it actually is kind of just calming in the sense of you're like, oh my gosh, I'm not just like a series of thoughts of like catastrophizing. I'm like here in this moment and everything is actually fine right now.
You know, Aparna, one of the things that's emerging in the clinical literature, you know, is if you look at the history of clinical science, like there was this deep interest in like psychosis and schizophrenia, like the dramatic ones, right? And then with the SSRI revolution, we were really interested in depression. And now we're really thinking a lot about anxiety. And it was one of these unspoken of conditions that really people suffered from a lot, like I did. And I'm curious, like knowing what you know now, what would you tell the young Aparna about her mind and her life?
I mean, I think, when I was younger, I contextualized my anxiety as like me being weak versus just like sucking it up and getting on with it. And I think it would have really helped if I just told myself, you know, actually everyone's scared and no one really knows what they're doing. And even the people who are most, you know, outwardly seem super confident, you know, gung-ho, charging ahead. Like, I think they might have just constructed the most elaborate front, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're any more equipped than the rest of us. Like, if anything, I'm more authentically living the human truth.
Well, Aparna Nancherla, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about anxiety and doing the practice, and thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for the great conversation.
Anxiety can feel like a terrible disease, so it makes sense we'd all want a magical cure for it, right?
We have skills when it comes to emotion, especially like anxiety. So when we think of it as a disease, it's an opportunity cost in terms of turning toward this experience and learning the skills to navigate.
That's psychologist Tracy Dennis-Tawari, an anxiety researcher who created the practice that our guest tried today. We're going to hear from Tracy about the science and why anxiety can be a sign of hope for the future. More after this break.
Hey, grown-ups, have some curious kids in your life? I'm Molly Bloom, the host of Brains On, a science podcast for curious kids and adults. Each week, a different kid co-host joins me to find answers to fascinating questions like, can you dig a hole to the center of the earth? Do plants have feelings? And why do we lie? Plus, we have mystery sounds to guess, songs to dance to, and lots of facts, all checked by experts. You can listen to Brains On wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to The Science of Happiness. I'm Dacher Keltner. We've been talking about anxiety and how to cope with it, and how for most of us, anxiety feels like something we need to prevent or avoid.
And the problem with that story is that it makes us more anxious about anxiety and really primes us to do more of the unhelpful things when it comes to anxiety and fewer of the helpful things.
Tracy Dennis Tiwari is an anxiety researcher and psychology professor at Hunter College. I spoke with her about the research that led her to conclude that anxiety is really a sign of hope for the future. Tracy is the author of the new book, Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. And I highly recommend it, especially for those who live with lingering anxiety. Here's a part of Tracy in my conversation. You know, we throw around the word anxiety so much in terms of clinical issues, and I'm feeling anxious, and climate anxiety, and how do you define it?
Anxiety is nervous apprehension about the uncertain future. And this is really important. It's making us into mental time travelers into the future, where we have to use one of the great achievements of human evolution, which is the ability to hold in mind and to simulate the future, something that has not happened yet, and to hold in mind that there could be something bad coming around the bend, but there could also simultaneously be something good. And what anxiety does in terms of information is it tells us there's this uncertainty, but it's priming us to navigate that uncertainty, to avert disaster, and to make the positive possibilities into reality.
You know, the sense that you get from certain wellness programs or positive psychology or whatever the case may be is that, you know, let's live an anxiety-free life. And you would suggest that that's actually a terrible mistake and leads us down the wrong path. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it would be a disaster. Number one, because it's impossible. And, you know, anxiety is a feature of being human, you know, and because it's information we have about the uncertain future. And thank God we have that information. I kind of think we might still be in caves if it weren't for anxiety. It inhabits that same space that creativity does. It's that bridge between where we are now and where we want to be. One analogy I love is the analogy of a smoke alarm. The smoke alarm goes off in your house. Now, we could just put earplugs in or go to a different room in the house where, you know, or we could, you know, but that's not what we do. We also don't necessarily take it as a call to panic, but we take it as a call to investigate. And what anxiety does is it's saying, okay, you have this uncertain future. And when you're anxious, it's telling you that you care about that future because you can't ignore it. And you need to investigate. When you think about anxiety as this information that you really need to pay attention to, you also realize that it means that you're still hopeful about that future.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, Lincoln was famously anxious, our greatest president. Mm-hmm. Charles Darwin, mm-hmm. profoundly anxious. We need to have agitated uncertainty about what the future could be. That's how futures get better, right?
And emotions, because they're a motivation, they're energy, that energy needs somewhere to go. And anxiety happens to be an activating emotion. And it's one that doesn't just trigger, you know, autonomic fight, flight, sort of. It increases oxytocin.
No way.
The social bonding hormone. Oh, yeah. And this is, we scientists don't always ask these questions, right? Because we're like, oh, it's the threat detection and response system. Why even look at oxytocin? Well, people have looked at oxytocin. And what you find is that, especially with, you know, not necessarily full-blown panic, but with moderate levels of anxiety, you actually increase levels of oxytocin, which primes us to seek out social connection and support, right? So it's almost like a fractal beauty that within anxiety, it contains some of its own solutions.
It's amazing. You know, a challenge that a lot of this literature faces is just, you know, when you talk about somebody who's really suffering profound anxiety or deep panic attack, how do you think about that?
We could have frequent and pretty strong anxiety every day and not be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. Because the key difference is that the disorder is diagnosed with functional impairment, which means that the way that we're coping with those intense feelings are disrupting our ability to live our life fully and well in ways that we want to. So what that means is that it's not so much that we have a crisis with anxiety as we have a crisis with how we're coping with anxiety.
Wow. So I'm going to get concrete coming out of that idea. And a lot of the young people, and personally myself too, and a lot of friends are like going through more fluctuations of anxiety. And I'm curious, coming out of this conceptual analysis that you're offering of the utility of anxiety and the necessity of it, what are like two or three things that you can do if someone's like, oh, I'm feeling kind of anxious about the future? What do you recommend?
I do give three principles that I think can help.
Nice.
So the first principle is anxiety is information. Listen to it, right? Then that's the whole thing we've done. But the second principle is, you know, sometimes anxiety is not useful. let go of it and immerse yourself in the present. Again, let go of that future tense. And then the third principle is, if you've, you know, circled back to anxiety, you've let it go for the moment, but you've come back and you've decided that there's some useful information about the world, things you care about, the future, hope, then hitch it to a sense of purpose. And so I'll give a very small example of how this might play out. So my son is in seventh grade, he's 13. And just the other day, this big math test was coming up. And he said, Mom, you know, I studied for this math test. I thought I studied the right amount. I'm really worrying about it. I'm anxious. And he said, hey, you wrote the book about that. What should, you know, hey, you're the expert. What should I do? I said, well, first of all, it sounds like you care about this math test because, you know, we're only anxious when we care about things. And I said, okay, so what are you worrying about? What's the information here? He said, I don't quite understand it. So I don't actually feel prepared, even though I studied a lot. And I said, okay, is there something to do about that? The test is tomorrow. He said, well, you know, I could study for 10 more minutes. Let me give that a try. And then he came back. He said, hey, I'm starting to not worry so much. And my anxiety is going down. I said, oh, well, I think that means you're on the right track. Now, that's a simple story. It wasn't sort of a crisis situation, right, but it was pretty big for him.
Right.
We knew it was information about what he cared about in the world, not a signal to panic. It was a call to action. And he was able to hitch that to a sense of purpose that he was able to pursue. And actually, because he cares about math, it gives him meaning in life. So it's a process. It's like a wave, right? Like you can drown. Anxiety, you can drown in that wave. You can learn to swim. And maybe if you keep working at it, you can surf. You know, it's like, that's what it is in our life. If we can think about it that way, I just think we'll do more of the helpful things and fewer of the unhelpful things.
Well, Tracy Dennis Tiwari, thank you so much. And thank you for your book, Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for Us, Even Though It Feels Bad. I think a lot of people will be finding allies and new forms of empowerment in the anxiety that's part of our 21st century. And I'm grateful for your work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dacre. I'm so grateful to have spoken with you.
You can find instructions to this surfing anxiety practice and learn more about Tracy's work in our show notes. On our next episode, we hear from a formerly incarcerated person about the power of creating your own positive memories and making the most of really tough circumstances.
This would not be the end of my story. I will not be known for only this. I went in as a caterpillar, made a cocoon, and I came out a butterfly. Strong butterfly.
I'm Dacre Keltner. Thanks for joining us on The Science of Happiness. What did you think about this surfing anxiety practice? Share your thoughts with us at happinesspod@berkeley.edu or use the hashtag happinesspod. Our executive producer of audio is Shuka Kalantari. Our producer is Haley Gray. Sound designer Jenny Cataldo of Accompany Studios. Our editor-in-chief is Jason Marsh, and our associate producer for this episode is Elena Neal Sachs. The Science of Happiness is a co-production of UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center and PRX.